books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show, recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and today we're celebrating World Book Day. On today's show, we'll hear from 11 of the £1 or €1.50 books that you can get free from RNIB in audio and braille. We'll hear about all the books for beginner readers, early readers, fluent readers, and independent readers throughout today's show. And between those book selections, we have a couple of warm hugs of an interview. We'll hear from the late, great Michael Bond about the origins of Paddington, and we'll hear how Julia Donaldson made some illustrations in audio. All coming up on today's Read On. World Book Day is a charity that champions reading for fun because it seriously improves lives. They want more children to grow up with a lifelong, life-changing habit of reading for fun and all the benefits this brings. World Book Day is all about throwing off pressures and expectations around reading and affording children the right to choose which books and forms of reading they want to engage with. Every school pupil gets a £1 or a €1.50 book token, which they can exchange for a special World Book Day book. And RNIB have made these books available in braille and audio. Here are the books available for those just beginning to read. The Big Bang by Rose Ailing Ellis. Uh-oh, where did Casper go? When a noisy storm scares Halo and Rocky, they don't realise their friend Casper can't hear the thunder. But when lightning flashes, Casper dashes off. Can Halo and Rocky be brave, find Casper, and learn a new way to communicate with their friend?
Casper, with a white kitten with a super fluffy tail. Where had he come from? Why was he here? Was he friendly? Rocky gave him a sniff. Halo circled him. Meow. Casper watched him intensely with big blue eyes and purred. Yes, he was friendly. So off they bounded into the woods, with Rocky and Halo leading the way. In the cool, leafy woods, Rocky tugged at the tree branch and Halo rolled it for a swim. Casper wanted to join in, but the two kittens hissed at Casper and pushed him away. Confused, Casper watched as they gathered leaves and branches. Ah, now he understood. They were building a den. He could help. He tugged some cardboard to Rocky. He helped wind the string with Halo. All three kittens pushed a branch with their noses. The den grew bigger and bigger and bigger. Casper felt so proud of himself. He had made friends and a den. The kittens played together. They'd jump up onto the roof and whoosh down into the leaves.
The Big Bang is read by Rose Ailing Ellis. Next up is Peppa Pig, One Big Family. Meet Peppa Pig. She lives with Mummy Pig, Daddy Pig, her little brother George, and her baby sister Evie. Today they are going to a family fun day at the park. There's going to be a giant picnic and team games. When Peppa's best friend Susie Sheep is sad that her team is smaller than everyone else's, what will Peppa do to help?
It's family fun day and Peppa is very excited.
There's going to be a giant picnic and team games,
she says.
I think Evie is just as excited as you are, Peppa,
says Daddy Pig. When everyone arrives, Madame Gazelle announces the start of Family Fun Day.
It's picnic time!
Hooray!
We've brought carrots.
says Rebecca Rabbit.
So have we,
says Mummy Pig.
Evie is trying mashed carrots for the first time today.
Everyone is enjoying the picnic, especially baby Evie. But Susie Sheep is feeling sad.
My granny is on holiday, so my family is just me and my mummy today. How will we play the big team games?
For more information on these books and Welsh and Irish books exclusive to those countries, head to worldbookday.com. And to order your audio or braille books from RNIB, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
More books for slightly older readers coming in a moment after we hear from Julia Donaldson.
Julia Donaldson paid a visit to the Talking Book Studios to record for us her book Freddy and the Fairy, and I was with her every step of the way.
Hello, I'm Julia Donaldson and I'm going to read Freddy and the Fairy. I just got here on the train and after I had a piece of toast and a cup of tea for breakfast. Is that all right?
That's fine, that sounds awful nice actually.
Freddy and the Fairy by Julia Donaldson. This book is produced by RNIB. Freddy found a fairy tangled in a tree.
Help! I'm stuck!
The fairy cried. So Freddy set her free.
Thank you!
As with all talking books, especially children's books where characterisation is perhaps more important, there was debate over the characters' voices.
Yeah, I'm quite pleased with that. The only thing I find a bit difficult is Freddy's voice. You know, I think I'm doing Freddy's voice. I mean, I don't want him to be too unpleasant. You know, he is a bit of a brat, quite, I suppose. You know, he's. Let me just think. I wish I had a pet. I'd rather have a dog. Do you think something a bit more like that? Uh-huh. A little rather than I wish I had.
Yeah, maybe that's a bit deep.
A little bit, not quite so deep.
My name is Bessie Bell. I'll grant you all your wishes, though I can't hear very well.
Freddy thought, then mumbled, I wish I had a pet.
Why, so you shall, said Bessie Bell, and conjured up a net.
Freddy and the Fairy is being recorded for blind and partially sighted listeners, but the book itself is actually about hearing problems. Julia explains more.
It's actually a book about a deaf fairy. I'm a bit deaf myself. And I had this idea ages ago of a fairy just muddling up wishes. I thought that'd be quite funny. And a little boy wishing, say, for a dog and getting something totally different. Mm. Originally, I was going to have the fairy just mixing up different people's wishes. And then actually one of my sons said to me, Mum, why don't you make the fairy deaf and then she could just mishear the wishes. So when the when the boy wishes for a dog, he gets a frog. When he wishes for a cat, he gets a bat and so on. But the story's got a moral because it turns out that the little boy's mumbling and he's covering up his mouth. He's not looking at the fairy. And once he's learnt how to talk clearly, then all his wishes start to come true.
A problem arose as we got to the end of the book.
The very ending of the book shows just in the pictures that Freddy is wishing for a caterpillar and the fairy, probably just mischievously by this stage, she gives him a gorilla and said she pretends she hasn't heard and he gets a gorilla, and that's just quite a funny picture, but it's just shown in the book in thought bubbles. So I thought, well, how can I do this? How can I get this over with in a just a purely audio version?
A number of solutions as to how to convey the ending were discussed, including an audio description of the pictures.
The only trouble with that for this book is because it's such a in a way, it's the only instance.
It's just the one at the end.
And also because it's a rhyming, you know, I wouldn't want... You know, if it's not a rhyming book, then that'd be fine. Like, you do get books. I saw a book once which is about an imaginary friend. Mm. And it says, you know, every time Jane went to the park, Mr. Monkey came too, and you just see, there's just a picture of Jane going to the park, you know, and then it says, you know, when Jane went to school, Mr. Monkey sat in the seat next to her, and you can't see, and you sort of realise that Mr. Monkey is an imaginary friend, but if you couldn't see, you would imagine that Mr. Monkey was in the pictures, and you wouldn't, you know, so then you would need someone to explain. Though that would be the way to do it. Another voice just at the end said, hold on, and everything he wishes for comes true.
I wish I had a caterpillar.
Or very nearly. He's got a gorilla. So Freddie learnt the three gold rules, and now he speaks quite clearly, and everything he wishes for comes true. Ooh, ooh, meow, meow, ooh, ooh. I wish I had a caterpillar. Or very nearly. Oh, no, I've got a gorilla. I don't know if that would work like that. And it, of course, you could just say at the end, in the pictures, in the book, Freddie was wishing for a caterpillar. He ended up getting a gorilla. And I thought that worked well. I just didn't think that would be that great. And so I actually sat down in this building, in the building with the recording studios, and I wrote an extra verse saying, you know, I can't remember actually what the, I can't remember off the heart, but I've written a special extra verse for this audio recording.
Now, Freddie,
said the Fairy Queen. She sounded kind but stern.
Before you wish again, there are three rules for you to learn. Rule one, you mustn't mumble. Rule two, don't turn away. The fairy needs to see your lips to read the words you say. Rule three, don't cover up your mouth. She can't see through your hand. Obey these three gold rules, and then I'm sure she'll understand.
So, Freddie learnt the three gold rules, and now he speaks quite clearly, and everything he wishes for comes true, or very nearly.
A dog, a cat, a bird, a mouse. What next? A caterpillar?
The fairy laughed and conjured up a super-sized gorilla.
When we had finished recording all the audio for the book, Julia joined me for a chat, and I asked her about the start of her writing career.
Well, and I don't know if you want me to go right back to when I was at school, because I just always loved writing, really, from the time I learnt physically to write. And I do remember when I was at primary school, and I must have only been about five, and I wrote a story about a rabbit who was running away from a farmer and hid behind this shop counter, but his ears were poking up, and the farmer saw his ears and thought they were his ears, but the shopkeeper said, oh no, that's two carrots. And so even at the age of five, I was writing stories about trickster animals.
And I believe your first book, A Squash and a Squeeze, actually came from a song that was written for TV.
That's right, because, I wrote songs really for about 20 years before I wrote books. I used to write lots of songs for programmes like Play School, Play Days, Play Away. And A Squash and a Squeeze was a song I wrote based on an old Jewish folk tale. And it was done on television. And many years later, I got this phone call out of the blue from a publisher saying, could they use the words of that song as a picture book? So that's how I got started in books.
What sort of songs were you asked to write then?
All sorts of really strange things. I mean, they would phone me up. They always seemed to want two songs, you know, which was quite good fun, actually, because when you got as far as you could with one, you'd go over to the other and you'd be sort of juggling them around. So, like one time they said, could I write one song about silly slippers and another song about crumpling up bits of wrapping paper and throwing them into the bin? So I never turned anything down.
Now, with your picture books, how does the process work? Are you and, say, Axel Schaefer, who illustrated The Gruffalo, are you in the same room? Or are you?
No, not at all. I mean, he doesn't really even know whether I'm writing a new book, what it would be about. So I write completely on my own. And I don't even send the text to Axel. I'll send it to my editor, and she's the intermediary, she's the go-between. And then when Axel's doing the pictures, I'm not breathing down his neck either. You know, it's quite a separate process.
Do you ever get the illustrations back and think, that's not how I pictured him?
Well, of course, it's not going to be how you picture it. I think it's a bit like when you go on a holiday, you probably think, oh, Menorca's going to be like this, or, you know, Africa's, the safari park's going to be like that. And when you get there, it's never exactly as you've imagined it. But before long, you adjust to what you've actually got. So it's the same, really, with the illustrations.
Now, you're famous for your picture books, but you've also written books for older people, the Giants and the Joneses, and even older with Running on the Cracks. Will you ever write an adult novel?
If I did, I'd love to do something like Ruth Rendell. I really admire the crime writer Ruth Rendell, but especially her more psychological novels. I'd love to do something like that, but I don't really think I'm quite observant enough. A lot of my books are really quite fable-like, and it's difficult to explain, but anyway, it's very difficult to clear the decks as well. I just have such a busy life. That's my excuse anyway. It's so important for books to be available in audio. Children start off, before they can read, don't they? They start off hearing stories, hearing their parents telling stories. And I see audiobooks as being a wonderful continuation of that tradition. I was really shocked when I read that only a quite small percentage of the total number of books that there are available for blind people. And of course, when you want to write a book, you want everyone to get it. You're not trying to write for just the sighted section of the population. I think it's absolutely vital that people who are blind can get the stories.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
And now back to our second batch of World Book Day books. Here are the books available for early readers. Unicorn Academy, My Secret Unicorn Diary. Peek inside Sophia and Wildstar's magical world and find out what Sophia really thinks of their first year together at Unicorn Academy in this exclusive mini diary. Filled with sparkling unicorns, epic adventures and mysterious secrets, are you ready for something magical?
I can't believe it! I, Sophia Mendoza, have just been invited to the world's best riding school. Is this for real? I'll be riding horses all day, every day. Just like my dad. It's everything I've ever wanted. Of course, Mom took some convincing to let me go. But now her awesome daughter is all set. She really is the best mom ever. Goodbye, farm. Hello, Nuncior Academy.
Next up for early readers is Funny Factopia. Welcome! You have landed in Funny Factopia, a world of hilarious, weird and amazing facts. Every fact is connected in surprising and comical ways. Follow a trail that hops from facts about astronauts to facts about zebras, and from facts about candy floss to facts about kings and queens. And there isn't just one trail through these facts. Sometimes your path branches, and you can choose to jump to a completely different, but still connected, part of Funny Factopia. Where will your curiosity take you?
Smiles and faces. The word pareidolia describes the way we sometimes see faces, or other things, in random objects or images, like clouds or knots of wood. Sometimes chimpanzees smile and show their teeth to apologise to other chimps. Time to chop through more facts about teeth. 100 million years ago, birds had teeth. Snails have thousands of teeth. Rabbits' teeth keep growing for their whole lives. Beavers have orange teeth. And the hardest stuff in the human body is the coating on your teeth.
While we're inside the body...
Muscles. There are no muscles in your fingers. If you can control your auricular muscles, you can wiggle your ears. The biggest muscle in your body is in your bottom.
Also for early readers is Pablo and Splash, The Castle Quest, by Sheena Dempsey. Time-travelling penguins Pablo and Splash are on a quest. Splash has heard there was an unlimited supply of delicious fishy snacks in medieval England. She heads straight to the time machine, pulling best pal Pablo along by the flipper. They soon meet some sheep, a pig, and a very angry farmer, but no sign of tasty treats at all. Will they have better luck inside the castle? Or is it time to say good night?
They never go hungry anyway. Antarctica has all the krill we need.
To the time bender! Forthwith! Farewell, Professor!
Bye!
Wow! You will just find any excuse to time travel. Slow down, Splash, and stop dragging me!
Wakey, wakey, time bender!
Hello, Pablo and Splash.
We need to time travel today!
You want to time travel today, you mean?
Hop in.
Best behaviour, time bender, okay? We don't want any trouble.
Trouble? Me?
To medieval England, time bender, and don't tarry.
Tarry?
We are on our way.
And finally for early readers, Pia's Pet Club, Iguana Escape, written by Serena Patel. Today we're all so excited about seeing the amazing Animal Roadshow, and especially its star, Iggy the Iguana. But somehow Iggy has disappeared. This is Pet Club's big moment. It's time to work together, think fast, and use all our pet knowledge to find him. Otherwise, the show will be ruined. But Iggy is nowhere to be seen. Can an iguana really just vanish?
We all look at each other. Did someone say Iggy was gone? I run into the tent, closely followed by the others. There's chaos everywhere. Crates are upturned, a bucket of feed rolls past, almost tripping us. And someone whizzes by, shouting, "Close that lid, the snake is in that one!" Hurry jumps behind me. "Snake? Where?" A woman in a brightly coloured jumper and green trousers runs around, looking under tablecloths and behind boxes, calling, "Iggy Wiggy, where are you?" Uncle Jinder stops her and asks, "Sarah, what happened?" She turns and waves her arms frantically. "Jinder, it's a disaster! Someone forgot to lock down the lids on the reptile tanks, and Iggy, our star iguana, has escaped!"
"Reptile tanks? As in more than one? How many exactly? Are any of them poisonous?"
Hurry asks. "What's with you?" I hiss. "Do you not like reptiles or something?" Hurry shivers. "They're just so slimy!"
"Actually, that's a myth," I say wisely.
Most reptiles have dry, scaly skin. It's amphibians like frogs and salamanders that can feel slimy.
For more information on these books, and Welsh and Irish books exclusive to those countries, head to worldbookday.com. And to order your audio or braille books from RNIB, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
And we'll have our final batch of World Book Day books in a moment. But first, let's hear from the late, great Michael Bond and the origins of Paddington Bear.
Mr. and Mrs. Brown first met Paddington on a railway platform. In fact, that was how he came to have such an unusual name for a bear, for Paddington was the name of the station. The Browns were there to meet their daughter Judy, who was coming home from school for the holidays. It was a warm summer day, and the station was crowded with people on their way to the seaside. Trains were whistling, taxis hooting, porters rushing about shouting at one another, and altogether there was so much noise that Mr. Brown, who saw him first, had to tell his wife several times before she understood. A bear? On Paddington Station? Mrs. Brown looked at her husband in amazement. Oh, don't be silly, Henry. There can't be. Mr. Brown adjusted his glasses. But there is, he insisted. I distinctly saw it. Over there. Behind those mailbags. It was wearing a funny kind of hat.
Paddington Bear first appeared on the 13th of October 1958 and was subsequently featured in more than 20 books written by Michael Bond. The polite immigrant bear from darkest Peru, with his old hat, battered suitcase, duffel coat and love of marmalade sandwiches, has become a classic character from English children's literature. Michael Bond joined me in the Talking Book Studios, and our interview actually started when I asked him for a few random lines to check his microphone level. Usually when you do this, for some reason, most interviewees will tell you what they had for breakfast. Guess what the creator of Paddington Bear had had that morning. Could I have a little line for level, please?
Yes, indeed. I'm... This morning I had my usual breakfast of toast and marmalade, which I have to have because that's Paddington's favourite thing. If I didn't have toast and marmalade, I don't know what my world would collect. Actually, it's very good for you, marmalade, I think. I wish I'd, in the beginning, I wrote the first book very quickly, and because I ate marmalade, I put marmalade in. I often wish I was pick something more exotic, like truffles or, you know, because people used to send me jars of marmalade through the post one time, and badly wrapped most of the time. So the postman would knock on the door and say, there's a parcel for you down at the office, Gov, and you get down there to pick it up, and there'd be bits of glass sticking out of it. And I did mention it once or twice, and it's eased off now. So
marmalade was your favourite before it was Paddington's then?
Paddington finds it very useful because he likes the chunks. He likes chunky marmalade. I remember doing an interview once with a librarian, and she said, "What about the chunks? What does a small child with?" I said, "What does Paddington do with the chunks?" And I said, "He finds it very useful as bookmarks." And I saw this librarian go quite tense. Thought of all her books having chunks of marmalade in them.
"Why, Henry," she exclaimed, I believe you were right. After all, it is a bear." She peered at it more closely. It seemed a very unusual kind of bear. It was brown in colour, rather dirty brown, and it was wearing a most odd-looking hat with a wide brim, just as Mr. Brown had said. And from beneath the brim, two large, round eyes stared back at her. Seeing that something was expected of it, the bear stood up and politely raised its hat, revealing two black ears. "Good afternoon," it said in a small, clear voice. "Good afternoon," replied Mr. Brown doubtfully. There was a moment of silence. The bear looked at them inquiringly. "Can I help you?" Mr. Brown looked rather embarrassed. "Well, no. As a matter of fact, we were rather wondering if we could help you."
Now, we know about the fictional origin of Paddington Bear, but where did they come from in reality?
Well, I was working as a television cameraman at the time, but I wrote my first short story when I was in the army in Egypt, and I'd always wanted to be a writer, and I carried on when I came out into Civvy Street again. And I was sitting one day with a blank sheet of paper and a typewriter in my small flat in just near Paddington, and I'd bought a small bear. It sounds like a sob story, but it's not actually, it's the truth. I went out shopping to get a kind of stocking filler for my wife, and I found myself in Oxford Street and it started to snow, and I went into Selfridges to get some shelter, and I found myself in a toy department, and there were very few other people in there because of the weather, and I came across a small bear who'd been sitting by itself on the shelf, and I, it sounds rather silly at the time, but I felt rather sorry for it. I think it's something about bears, you want to protect them, and I think there are many qualities that other creatures don't have. You feel with a bear you can tell it your secrets, and they're not going to, as far as children go, you can tell it their secrets, and you keep it safe. And anyway, I sort of hovered around, and on the spur of the moment I bought this bear and took it back to my wife, and because we live near Paddington, it seemed a nice, important name for it. And I think all bears, they've got this strange quality, you find yourself talking to them. And this one is quite small, about 6 inches big, I suppose, not like the real Paddington, we know. It used to sit on the mantelpiece, and I had a day off from working in television at the time, and I had this blank sheet of paper and a typewriter, and there's the awful knowledge that nobody's going to put any words on it unless you do. And I looked around at this bear, and I wondered what would happen to a real bear had it been found on Paddington Station. And I wrote the first words of what became a book. I mean, I had no intention of writing a book. It was just a doodle, and I had no intention of writing a children's book. But it caught my fancy, and I actually wrote the first book very quickly because I gave it all sorts of things that I was involved in my life. I mean, I used to wear a duffel coat myself, a government surplus duffel coat. So I thought the bear ought to wear a duffel coat, and I had an old government surplus hat, a bush hat, which I also wore, because this was 1956, but still we hadn't recovered from the war really, so people did wear duffel coats and government surplus things. And Mr. and Mrs. Brown, who found him on the station, were really my parents, and my mother would certainly have taken him. And my father was a civil servant, and he'd be worrying about whether they were breaking any kind of law or not. But it was my mother who actually ruled the house, and she was somebody who made up her mind straight away on the spur of the moment. There was no changing it. And she always saw things in terms of black and white. I mean, if it was raining, it was raining cats and dogs. And if the sun was out, it was blazing down. And I had memories of wartime when I was small, and I was living in Reading, and trains used to ride in just at the start of war from London carrying refugees, small children with all their belongings in a suitcase, and they had a label around their neck saying that their name and address and so on, in case they got lost. And I thought, well, Paddington ought to have a label around his neck saying, please look after this spare, and thank you after, which is most important.
But what are you going to do now? Said Mr. Brown. You can't just sit on Paddington Station waiting for something to happen. Oh, I shall be all right, I expect. The bear bent down to do up its case again. As he did so, Mrs. Brown caught a glimpse of the writing on the label. It said simply, please look after this bear. Thank you. She turned appealingly to her husband. Oh, Henry, what shall we do? We can't just leave him here.
I thought that it would be nice if they had some two children, one male, one boy and one girl.
Mm.
And I was brought up as a child, my best friend, they had what was known as a housekeeper. In actual fact, there were a lot of middle-class or lower middle-class people who had a member of the family who probably lost their husband or their boyfriend during the war. And so they were taken in by the family. So Mrs. Bird, who was the Baron's housekeeper, is not, as a lot of people think, a Cockney, genuine Cockney housekeeper. She is a member of the family. And she kind of rules the family. She's quite strict. And at that point, I thought, although it was very nice of the Baron's, Mr. and Mrs. Baron to take this bear in, they didn't necessarily totally understand what it was like to be a refugee. And it so happened, in the BBC I'd been working for an overseas department for a long time, monitoring service, which was mostly staffed by refugees, and they all had totally different stories to tell. And I thought, Paddington needs somebody who knows what it's like to be a refugee. So there's Mr. Gruber, who's got an antique shop, because I live near the Portobello Road at the time. I knew it very well. So all the surrounding country, which is in the books, is that particular area of London.
Mm.
And then I thought, well, everybody's been very nice up to now, and it needs somebody who's not quite so nice. So the Baron's next door neighbour, Mr. Curry. Mr. Curry is very useful because he's such an awful man and is always trying to get something for nothing. That you can get away with it, the fact that he deserves what he gets. So when Paddington wins over him, he deserves it.
Mrs. Brown bent down. You're a very small bear, she said. The bear puffed out its chest. I am a very rare sort of bear, he replied importantly. There aren't many of us left where I come from. And where is that? Asked Mrs. Brown. The bear looked round carefully before replying. From darkest Peru.
When I wrote the book, which I say I did very quickly, I did put in the original text that he came from darkest Africa, and I had an agent by then, and I sent it to him, and he said straight away, well, I like the book very much, but P.S. there aren't any bears in Africa. So I went to the library and studied it up a bit, and I was looking for some part of the world where English people never went, somewhere fairly remote. And so I discovered there are bears in Peru. And in those days, Peru was really not somewhere people ever went on holiday. And the interesting thing about it is that over the period of time, I'm always getting letters from people or schools saying that they were going to Peru because they wanted to go on the trail to see where Paddington was brought up and so on. It's a very popular place to go to these days.
Mm.
But at the time, it seemed very remote and ideal. I was supposed to go out to Peru at one point. Stephen Fry had read some of the books. And Stephen Fry is a marvellous reader for the Paddington books, and he's rather bear-like himself. But he went out on an expedition to see where Paddington was actually brought up, and so I was supposed to go with him, and unfortunately I one had to have a lot of inoculations and so on before going in those days. And one of them disagreed with me, and I wasn't allowed to travel, so I didn't go on the expedition, which wasn't quite such a bad thing, because the very first meal they had some shellfish in Lima, and everybody got almost hospitalised, so I escaped that.
"Well, let's settle them," said Mrs. Brown, before her husband could change his mind. "And you can have marmalade for breakfast every morning, and..." She tried hard to think of something else that bears might like. "Every morning?" The bear looked as if it could hardly believe its ears. "I only had it on special occasions at home. Marmalade's very expensive in darkest Peru." "Then you shall have it every morning, starting tomorrow," continued Mrs. Brown. "And honey on Sundays."
I think, when I wrote the first book, I always write to please myself, actually. Although they are obviously children's books because the hero is a bear, so they're not for any particular age group. And I there's a lot in there for adults as well, because I think reading should be a shared experience. I know when my daughter was small, if I was reading to her in bed, and I wasn't enjoying it, she'd say, "Daddy, you're not really enjoying this, are you?" And I would say, "Well, not really." And she'd say, "Well, let's read something else." So I try to make the books enjoyable to all ages. I think I was lucky enough to be brought up in a house where books were part of the furniture, and I never went to bed without a story. And it was just natural to pick up a book and read it. It was to turn on the tap, you know, which is, I think, a great start in life. And I think that's where the reading habit has to start, really, at home. It's no good saying when they go to school, let's hope they're taught to read properly when they get to school, because there's so many other distractions, particularly in this day and age with all the... I mean, small children these days have their own mobile telephones, and if they're lucky, they have a mini computer or something. So I think starting off reading at home, reading, having a bedside story is really a wonderful thing. What a nice warm thing, and it's a sort of binding. It's something which will last you for the rest of your life. I feel sorry for people who don't have that. Behind them.
Yeah, because unlike a lot of books that we feature on the show, the Paddington books are really designed to be read out loud.
Yes, I think if you have a good reader, as I say, Stephen Fry is a good reader of the Paddington books. It does bring them to life.
Even the best narrator, though, isn't as good as your mum or your dad, you know.
Oh no, absolutely no. I'm certainly not one of the best readers in the world. I like a lot of people, when I hear my voice on the radio, I think, oh dear. But if you get the voices right, it's very special.
There are many Paddington books available from RNIB. And Michael Bond, thanks so much for joining me on RNIB Connect Radio.
Well, thank you very much.
And now our final batch of World Book Day books.
Here are the books available for fluent readers. Skandar and the Secret Elements by A.F. Stedman. Albert never thought he would become a unicorn rider, but then he is whisked away to a mysterious island to bond with a warrior unicorn and to train in elemental magic. There, Albert meets a boy called Skandar, who is hiding a dangerous secret. Get ready for unlikely heroes, elemental battles, dangerous secrets, and bloodthirsty unicorns.
"It's definitely a mistake." Albert clung to this thought as he said goodbye to his excited family.
repeated it during the long drive with the rider liaison officer until they arrived at the chalk landmark, the white unicorn at Uffington that had been cut into the hillside longer ago than anyone could remember. Continued to focus on it as he was ushered into one of the helicopters transporting other rider hopefuls. "It's definitely a mistake," Albert murmured as the helicopter took off for the island. It wasn't yet dawn when they touched down onto a grassy clifftop. As the propellers spun slower, the pilot checked the names off a list. "Roberta Bruna?" The girl strapped in next to Albert undid her belt and narrowed her flinty eyes at the pilot. She had a brown bob with a fringe and purple painted nails. "It's Bobby Bruna. You'll want to remember that for when I win the Chaos Cup." The pilot laughed. Bobby didn't. "Albert Chapman?" the pilot continued. Yes? He clambered out of the helicopter after Bobby, his legs like jelly. In the morning twilight, a queue was forming across the clifftop of 13-year-old mainlanders and of islanders Albert's age too. Those right at the front were standing in the shadow of a green mound. The hatchery. Inside the ancient monument, there were unicorns ready to hatch once their destined riders arrived. A circular granite door, lit by lanterns on either side, protected the entrance. It would only open if you were destined to bond with a unicorn inside. If Albert couldn't open it, well, he wouldn't be able to, of course, because this was all a big mistake.
Also for Fluent Readers is Chaos at the Chocolate Factory by Sabile Pounder. An exclusive new World Book Day story inspired by Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory from best-selling author Sabile Pounder. When Mr. Wonka and the Oompa Loompas decide it's time to go on an adventure to look for marvellous new recipe ingredients, Charlie is left to run the factory by himself for the first time. And it's fair to say things don't quite go to plan. Can Charlie use his imagination to save the chocolate factory from disaster? Or will all the chaos mean closing the factory gates forever?
"Mr. Wonka," Charlie said, tearing through the factory and brandishing the advert for Professor Foulbody's machine. "I found just what we need." Mr. Wonka was chucking lots of vials of ingredients and pans for chocolate making into his suitcase and didn't look up. "Have you ever heard of a Professor Foulbody?" Charlie asked. That made Mr. Wonka jolt. Again, Charlie asked excitedly, "Have you, Mr. Wonka?"
"Yes. The man is an inventor," Mr. Wonka said. "But he doesn't invent things to eat, which is an absurd waste of time."
"Do his inventions work?"
"That's a question you'd have to ask him," Mr. Wonka said. "You really are determined to find a way for the Oompa Loompas to come with me, aren't you?"
Charlie nodded.
"Well, tell you what, you go to Professor Foulbody and see about that invention. If you think it means the Oompa Loompas can come with me, then I'll persuade them. Trust your instinct, Charlie. Go with your gut. Smell the solution. It's all part of the process."
He lifted his cane and began bouncing from foot to foot, as he liked to do.
"All part of the process of becoming a great chocolatier."
For fluent readers who love football, we have Unbelievable Football, the most amazing World Cup stories you never knew, by Matt Oldfield. Think you know everything about football? Get ready for kickoff and discover incredible stories, facts and stats about some of the most unbelievable World Cup football moments of all time. From the incredible teams to the most amazing goal scorers, unbeatable matches, last-minute saves, penalty dramas, and even the amazing animals that have been involved too. Packed full of true footballing stories and amazing action that will keep football mad readers going from the first minute to the final whistle.
Pelé's pretty awful World Cup predictions. Pelé will forever be remembered as one of the greatest footballers of all time. But as an expert on the beautiful game, not so much. Pelé was first asked for his World Cup predictions ahead of the 1994 tournament in the USA, and he answered, "For me, Colombia is the best team. It doesn't mean they are going to win it, but they will be one of the four semi-finalists." Unfortunately, they finished bottom of their group, and instead, the trophy was won by Pelé's home country, Brazil. Awkward. 4 years later, the king of football was asked again, and this time he picked Spain and Brazil as the two World Cup finalists. For Pelé, one out of two really wasn't bad. Brazil did make it all the way before losing to France, but Spain didn't make it past the group stage. After that, although Pelé didn't stop making predictions, he did start naming more teams each time. "I think the favourites are Argentina, France, Italy and Portugal," he said in 2002. Not only did none of his top four even reach the quarterfinals, but the tournament was won by the one team he said wouldn't have a good World Cup, Brazil. By then, his predictions had become known as the Pelé Curse. But surely, if he kept going, he had to get it right eventually. Ahead of the World Cup in 2010, Pelé said, "At the moment, we have Spain in Europe and Brazil in South America. They are the two best teams, no doubt." While Brazil lost in the quarterfinals, Spain went all the way and won the World Cup. Hooray! At last, the curse had been lifted.
Fluent readers in Ireland can also choose Millie McCarthy and the St. Patrick's Day Pandemonium by Leona Ford. Millie's class has been chosen to represent their school at the local St. Patrick's Day parade. They decide on a float theme of Irish myths and legends. But while Millie thinks she'd be perfect as Queen Maeve, instead she's given the role of the back end of the Brown Bull of Cooley. What could possibly go wrong?
"Really, it all began because of a severe case of chickenpox that spread like wildfire around Rongashay in Scollone. In case you don't know, being in sixth class in Scollone means that you finally get to do something totally brilliant and super cool. And I'm not even talking about being responsible for giving out the bottles of Bonia to the younger classes. I'm talking about something even better. Mr. Manley, who is our principal and my mortal enemy because he thinks I'm a total pain in the butt, believes that pupils in sixth class are generally mature and responsible young scholars. And that is why he trusts them to represent Skull Owen in the Ballybrogan St. Patrick's Day Parade, which is what sixth class should have been doing if it hadn't been for all the spots and itching and calamine lotion that made them all look like polka-dotted ghosts."
And finally, for those more independent readers, friend of Read On, Nate Lasore, has written Against All Odds. Footballer, hustler, one of the boys. He's got the playground game on lock and big plans for his mum's surprise birthday party this weekend. But poetry, that's just something he does quietly, in his head, on the bus, between goals. Until his teacher spots his talent and encourages him to enter a creative writing competition. Naranto laughs it off. No chance, the deadline's in 3 days and he's already got way too much going on. His mates agree and tell him to stick to what he knows. Poetry doesn't win matches.
My family are so silly. My aunt's profile picture on WhatsApp is a super close-up of her face in the 90s. My grandparents both use the same picture of them on holiday, where they're posing from so far away you can barely see them. And my uncle's tried taking a selfie, but the top of his head is cropped off, so he looks like Gargamel. I'm typing out a message to copy and paste to all of them, plus a few others. A reminder to be at ours on Sunday for 4 p.m. sharp. I don't actually want them there until 5, but if I said that, then they'd all turn up at 6 or 7. I lie in bed scrolling as I wait for them to confirm. My room is small and covered in anime posters that I've been collecting for years. I used to sit around drawing and designing my own characters, but that took a back seat when I hit secondary. Most of my time is spent in the cage now or on road, but if I ever got the funds, I still indulge my poster collection. Safe haven. Childhood drawings I've been saving. Battles outside, this is my salvation. Armies collide. Black and white, but I'm a grey raven. Bar me and the fam, rocky roads stop at my door. Normal decisions, sailing smooth like a face shaven. Dila, my big sister, is coming down for Mum's birthday as a surprise. She's in Coventry studying science. Something to do with plant life cycles. To be honest, I have no idea what she does. She's explained it a bunch of times, but my brain can't keep up.
For more information on these books, and Welsh and Irish books exclusive to those countries, head to worldbookday.com. And to order your audio or braille books from RNIB, call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
RNIB is only one of a number of charities making World Book Day accessible. The books are available in large print from Guide Dogs and in audio and alternative formats from Calibre, Vision Ireland, Child Vision and Listening Books. Simply search for World Book Day Accessibility for the full list. We'll be back with another Read On at the same time next week.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.